In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Call me crazy, but it just seems that during a national emergency, the government's first concern should be to protect your rights, not take them away. Otherwise, it's a bit like saying, trust me, I'm going to keep you safe by punching you in the face until you do everything I tell you to do without question. Now, I suppose a bureaucrat could say, look, when a building's on fire, our first priority is to get you out of it, not worry about whether or not you can exercise your right to free speech. Okay, that might sound reasonable, but you don't need to take away someone's free speech to get them out of the building. And the other half of that solution is they're taking you out of a building they say is on fire and putting you in a concentration camp. That's not a solution. As I said, what really gets me is they did this in a time of crisis when our constitutional rights should matter the most. And yet those rights and guarantees were the first to be thrown under the bus in the guise of protecting us. It's been said character shines through in a time of crisis. So what have we learned about our government's character in this time of crisis? This should have been a time when we saw our government at its best. All this time, the Constitution should have been preventing the government from terrorizing people into submission. Instead, we've seen government taking away First Amendment rights, stopping you from the free exercise of your religious beliefs, taking away free speech and the right to peacefully assemble and to protest from some, while allowing others free speech because they were saying what fit the political needs of Democrats in power and allowing them to violently assemble, trampling on constitutionally protected private property rights while smashing and burning and looting private property itself. What's it say about a government when they only protect the rights of some of their citizens? Are we a government for all or not? Until all of government stands up for all of its citizens, we don't really have a constitution. We have a government where some people are more equal than others. The good news is, for now, the Constitution still matters, but it's up to us to defend it. The fight for freedom is an everyday fight, and there's some good news out there on that front. I'd like to welcome Kimberly Herman back to the show. She is the general counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation, and they just had a big win in federal district court for property rights. Kimberly, welcome back.
Great to be back with you.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, you guys just had a major win for economics, the Constitution, and contract law. This was over the eviction moratorium that, yes, when you rent something, you do actually have to pay for it. And when you have a contract, the government can't just step in and shred it. And this is just a little blurb from a February 25th article on Southeastern Legal's website, slfliberty.org. Quote, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas entered a final judgment declaring the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's eviction moratorium order unconstitutional. So first off, why does the CDC get to determine and interfere with the contractual obligation between landlords and tenants in the first place? I mean, that just seems kind of crazy.
Yeah, well, they don't. And the federal court in this case definitively said that they don't. You know, to take the case back just a minute to give a little bit more context to what we're talking about here, we're talking about the CDC coming in and telling private property owners that you cannot kick somebody out of your property. So let's say I own a rental home. Somebody comes to me, they say, I can't pay you anymore, or rather, I'm not going to pay you because the CDC said I don't have to, and you can't make me leave. So you're essentially being forced to house other people for free, and the government is telling you that if you don't do this, you could be slapped with fines up to $100,000 or put in jail. Okay, so like that is what we're talking about here, the extent of it. And we brought a case along with Texas Public Policy Foundation on behalf of several landlords challenging this at the constitutional level. So our argument was that the CDC doesn't have the power to do this, and Congress doesn't even have the power to do this. And fortunately for all property owners across the country, he agreed. And so the CDC eviction moratorium no longer is in force.
So under the CDC's order, it said nothing in it relieved any individual of any obligation to pay rent. It didn't and did not stop a landlord from charging rent or charging interest and late fees on unpaid rent. You just couldn't evict them if they failed to pay rent. So why did Southeastern Legal pursue this particular case? Are you just meanies because you want landlords to evict people?
No, not at all. Despite what you might read on Twitter with the trolls these days.
Yes.
No, I mean, this is about fundamental property rights.
Right.
A lot of people have framed it, or the CDC has tried to frame it in a different light. This is not about the homeless problem. This is not about the pandemic. If it was, Congress can fix that. They have ways. We just, you know, we've seen them pass $1 trillion bills, multi-trillion dollar bills, in which they have $100 million going to New York to build a bridge between New York and Canada. They have all these pet projects in it. If they really want to help the renters, they have ways to do it that are legal and lawful. This is not one of those ways, plain and simple.
So in terms of this being effective in the Texas area, does it hold other states to these kind of same kind of standards?
Yeah, so it's our position that it does. Now, the CDC has come out and said that they are taking the position that it's only limited to our clients. Hmm. But the law says otherwise. The federal judge here declared this eviction moratorium as unconstitutional. What that means under the law is that it's now set aside and that they can no longer enforce it. We haven't seen them try to enforce it since. However, they said they're refusing to repeal it because they have appealed our order. And so when we win and prevail at the Fifth Circuit, and then ultimately prevail at the U.S. Supreme Court, they won't have any other choice than to acknowledge that it is gone throughout the country.
You know, a big part of the economically challenged left is that they assume that, well, there's this rich landlord and he can afford to not get any money for these renters. And they forget that he has that building because he paid for it. And so now he's trying to earn his money back on that. When this was first ordered, did you guys see an immediate reaction from tenants who said, yay, now we don't have to pay rent anymore?
We did. I mean, what we've been hearing across the country, because while we brought this case in the name of and on behalf of several landlords, we've been reached out to by hundreds and hundreds of landlords throughout the country. And they have renters who have been long-term renters who have always paid that are now coming to them and saying, you know, we don't have to pay. The CDC said it, so we're just not going to pay. And, you know, even more importantly, this isn't about the pandemic. And the CDC admitted as much before the judge. The judge in this case at our hearing directly asked the CDC, if there wasn't a pandemic, could you do this? And the DOJ attorney said, yes, if fairness requires it, we can impose an eviction moratorium.
Wow. Wow.
It's fairness. That's the standard that the CDC is trying to put out. That is what we are dealing with this Biden administration.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. That's where I was going to go with my next question, because this was a power that the CDC grabbed for itself. I mean, it was an agency doing this, not a legislature. And that's really one of the key parts from that article that I mentioned, is that because it's unconstitutional, it means that Congress can't come in and just write new law to impose eviction moratoriums, because those laws would also be struck down because it's unconstitutional. But I mean, that's the astonishing thing, really, that the fact that the government thought it could do this is really concerning. I mean, what's it like to go into court and hear those government lawyers defend this notion they can do anything they want, ignore the Constitution, as long as they call it a health emergency?
At moments like that, you're thankful that we're doing these hearings telephonically, because the shock on your face, you can't show that when you're in a courtroom. It was kind of nice to be over the phone with this one, so that the shock didn't come through.
Wow. Yeah, I bet. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, how will this impact other cases of government overreach? Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Kimberly Herman. She's with the Southeastern Legal Foundation. She's their general counsel for them. You can visit their website at slfliberty.org. And as far as this case that you guys won, pushing back on the moratorium that the CDC thought it had the right to impose on the nation there, where does this case lie now? Is it being appealed? What's going on?
Yeah, the DOJ actually appealed this faster than I've ever seen them appeal any case that we've been involved in our 50-year history. So right now it's going to be before the Fifth Circuit. We expect to have oral argument sometime this summer, and we fully expect this case to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, because it's not just about the eviction moratorium. It's about the overall power that these agencies think that they can grab, and they know that they're in danger right now, and they know that their power is in danger, because it's truly, it's an astonishing win, and we're very proud of it.
So if the CDC was allowed to interfere with private property rights and contractual obligations between landlord and tenant, I mean, you could just see how this could really open the door to all sorts of abuse. And in that article, Southeastern Legal says that, quote, "We are preparing cases across the constitutional spectrum to defend against unrestrained government action." So can you give us a hint on some of these other cases that you've got going?
Yeah, happy to. You know, as we mentioned before, we talked about how the CDC said that they can do whatever they want, basically under the view of fairness. What we're really talking there is something that, you know, you and I have talked about before, this idea of equity, this idea of unity, and the government saying that they can do anything if it's to that end. And so whether it's critical race theory and challenging that, which is something that Southeastern Legal Foundation is extremely involved in, with Christopher Rufo and an overall coalition that we've helped put together. That's one of the really big areas. I think out of the EPA, you know, the Biden administration has been very coy in what the EPA is going to do. But we know that they're going to try to use the same line of argument that they did with the CDC eviction to take unprecedented action against your property rights. And so we are just, you know, standing ready and waiting for those actions. And we're ready to challenge them, and we're ready to sue, and we're ready to win.
Well, I do know that one of the Biden's plans are that they're going to start applying fairness and equity to land ownership when it comes to some minorities. They want to encourage land ownership there. So I don't know if that means they're going to just offer them more money or what. I mean, you can see them, we're going to start taking away land here too. I mean, if that's what they thought they could do with just private property rights between a landowner and a tenant, I mean, you could see that would open the door to that kind of thing. In terms of opening doors, does this ruling open any doors to immediate rollbacks of some of these unconstitutional orders, whether it's from the CDC or the federal government and or state or local governments? In other words, they saw you won on this case, so maybe they'd start rolling back some other constitutional power grabs. Do you see that happening?
I don't see that happening. I wish that they would take a clue, but we know it's going to make them probably dig in their heels even deeper, to be honest. And that's why the battle is going to be in the courts. We have a phenomenal federal judiciary. President Trump did an amazing job, and the Senate did a great job at getting these judges confirmed. You know, we are dealing with a new Article III court. We are dealing with a new federal judiciary and a new Supreme Court. So that's where we're going to have to fight these. But I don't see the Biden administration backing down anytime soon.
Getting back to that notion of fairness and equity, do they give you any kind of indication in terms of how they determine what is fair and the equity side of things? I mean, that just seems like they're seizing that power again for themselves and using that as the excuse to exercise that power. Where does this sense of fairness even come from?
You're completely correct. In the law, it has absolutely no grounding. It's a new standard that they've created. You know, one way that we keep talking about it as we bat things around our office is it ties back to the cancel culture, right? It's what rights are they going to cancel and how can they cancel them? And if it's creating new standards such as fairness, such as equity, which does not show up in the Constitution or the law anywhere at all, then that's what they're going to do, right? Say it enough and people might believe it. If you can't rip up the Constitution in front of everyone, let's just shred it to pieces by creating new standards. And that's what they're trying to do. So we have a long battle ahead of us, but there is hope. And if there's one thing that this win shows everyone, it's that there is hope for our movement and there is hope for the Constitution.
Yes, and that's very encouraging. Just to hear you talk there, if this ties back into cancel culture, they're not talking fairness, they're talking mob rule.
Correct. That's exactly. And it keeps them in power. Right? Because all you're doing there is pitting people against each other, right? It's the oppressed versus the oppressor versus the oppressed. And in everything here, you've got the landlord, who they're claiming is the oppressor, versus the renter, who's the oppressed. Well, I see it a very different way, right? These landowners, they have to pay their bills. They have to pay their mortgage. They have to keep up the property, right? Who's helping them do that?
Yeah.
They are doing it themselves. They're carrying that entire burden. And so you can easily turn the narrative around on them. It's just that, you know, they're the ones out there throwing at everyone's face every day. So we're just going to keep fighting in court.
Well, and not only that, but the landlords are providing a home that the renter couldn't otherwise afford. Mm-hmm. That's the other
Correct.
Aspect that they seem to be missing. Only got about a minute and a half here with you. If the CDC could swoop in and make unconstitutional power grabs by taking away private property, not to mention infringe on First Amendment, such as freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, what was stopping them from saying, gee, during a pandemic, we need to take away guns because people might be more prone to shooting themselves or others? I mean, is that the track we were on? And why didn't they? I mean, are you surprised they never did try
Fear,
that?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm glad they didn't go that far. I'm sure that there are people that want to go that far. We know that from some of the legislation that we're seeing. We saw, you know, HR 1 get through, and it makes me a little nervous as to for what's coming in the Second Amendment. I wouldn't put it past them. They're sure going to try, but we're sure going to try to stop them.
Well, it's nice to think that maybe your court case actually stopped them from going in that direction. Let's go and take a break. She did mention HR 1. We'll talk about that next coming up, the future of voting. Welcome back. Kimberly Herman is General Counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation, which is dedicated to advocating limited government, protecting American freedom, and defending individual liberties. Their website is slfliberty.org. We'll put that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And Kim, I think most reasonable people would agree that if you can't fix the voting system and restore faith in it, that it is truly fair and open, then it doesn't really matter who runs in 2022 or 2024. If rampant cheating is allowed. And Monday this week, the Supreme Court did not take up two cases by Sidney Powell and pass on them without comment. The last time we had you on, we didn't get your thoughts on the election cases. And now with these from Sidney, in your opinion, why did the Supreme Court never take up a single election fraud case? I mean, I know the speculation was that they didn't want to redo the election, but when it's stolen, that seems like that's the time to step in. Don't they have a duty to take that up? Because effectively they said, we don't want to look at a murder case because the victim's already dead. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, well, in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court, they do have the discretion to take what cases they believe are cases that they should hear. Doesn't mean that we agree with their decisions there. You know, one thing I've noticed is that the more that the Supreme Court, and I say this respectfully because I do practice there, but the more that the Supreme Court tries to depoliticize itself, the more the general public sees it as being political.
Yep.
And I don't know how that can be fixed. Maybe it is by taking these cases. You know, some of them, maybe they were not the right cases for them to take. But certainly, and Justice Thomas even opined on this, not taking them because the election is over is not a good enough reason to not take a case that the Supreme Court should hear.
Yeah, because I loved his dissenting opinion on that. We'll see if we can put that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And I mean, you're right. You don't restore faith by ignoring it. It's like telling the IRS, oh, there's no fraud in this company and you can't see our books. I mean, do you think the IRS would believe that if that's your standard?
No, not as a real question. Absolutely not.
Yeah, a little flippant, but I mean, it's like the Ford company back in the 70s. They didn't fix their trust by ignoring complaints about exploding Pintos. You've got to address the situation. So also concerning, though, in all of this, in the face of rampant voter fraud and election irregularities, the very first bill right out of the gate that the Democrats drafted was H.R. 1. And this would actually institutionalize a lot of the voter fraud that we saw in 2020. It just passed the House on Wednesday with only one Democrat opposing it. But it does need 60 votes in the Senate since it's not a budget bill. Among the provisions, it would force states to implement a minimum of 15 days of early voting, offer mail-in ballots, and allow them to be counted up to 10 days after Election Day, same-day registration in every state, and allow no excuse absentee ballots. Would you care to comment on H.R. 1?
Where do we start? Do we have enough time? It's a disaster. I mean, it is going to create a tremendous amount of additional election fraud and real fraud. We're talking additional mail-in ballots. This auto voter registration piece is really concerning to me. I can tell you here in Georgia, they're actually trying to undo that.
Yes.
Because it has led to so many people who should not be on the voter rolls voting, right? So many illegal aliens and even felons that are voting.
Well, and also we've learned that the Dominion machines allegedly, they will pull from a folder of people who are registered but who haven't voted in order to make up the difference when their candidate of choice is losing. That was one of the real revelations and with all of these allegations that are out there. I just find that astounding because I could never figure out why the Democrats were so focused on registering voters. Well, and that would explain it. If they are out there cheating, they've got this cache of registered voters from which they could draw and say, oh, yeah, that person totally voted for a Democrat. I mean, that I think is really astounding.
Yeah, I mean, I've read those claims. I've also read other claims of people handwriting in ballots for people who were registered that didn't actually go vote. I haven't, you know, driven those to the ground, but those are all certainly out there. You know, there's a few other pieces to H.R. 1 that are really troubling, too. It's this disclosure piece, really trying to get to the crux of who's behind C3s and who's behind C4s and other groups like that. It goes along with what we've seen from the Democrats in trying to force conservative organizations to disclose their donors. And we at SLF have said, we're going to close our doors before we're going to tell you who our donors are. We protect that with everything we have.
Well, but won't that mean that they're exposing their own organizations to those same kind of disclosure laws? Or are they somehow setting up that only Republicans and conservative organizations have to reveal their donors? I mean, isn't that a trouble for their own side?
One would presume, but I, you know, the way that they're setting their groups up and the way that the some of the limits on this, not to get too far into the weeds, but if you're getting your grassroots donations that they then want public funds to match that at six times, which is another crazy piece. But these smaller donations, they might not meet the thresholds that they have put in there. And so they've gotten very crafty with how it goes and how it works. And, you know, there's also those who follow the rules and there's those who don't.
Yeah.
And then do they enforce it against?
It's funny that you said that because when I read that that piece there, I thought, well, all of this assumes that everybody will follow the rules. And, of course, as we just saw, that wasn't the case. We saw people more than willing to cheat. Real quick, there have been some ongoing cases of election integrity. SCOTUS blog wrote an article that the majority of the Supreme Court appear to favor two changes in that Arizona voting law case that just came before them. It would do away with ballot harvesting and that ballots cast outside of precincts can't be counted. But they reverted to, they meaning the SCOTUS blog, reverted to the race card. They said the real question is whether the majority will coalesce around a standard for determining whether voting laws and practices violate Section 2, which bans racial discrimination in voting. And you know, I'm just so tired of race being an excuse. This isn't the 1880s or the 1960s. We're in the 21st century. If people want to register to vote, they can. If they want to vote, they can. I just find that reprehensible that once again, we're back to the race card.
I agree. 100%. But the more they can make it about that, then the more they can talk about equity, then they can go back to the standard of fairness, which kind of comes first full circle to where we started, you know, our conversation today.
Yeah.
The more you can make race relevant, then the more power you can grab.
Yeah. Right now,
as a government.
Yeah. Right now, it's crazy how they're putting race into everything. You can't say anything without it somehow being racial. Well, fairness and equity is something that we're going to have to be revisiting. And we'd love to have you come back to talk more about that. Kimberly Herman, well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The iSpy Radio Show.
Good thinkers are always welcome here on iSpy Radio, and that's why we enjoy having Chuck Weiss on. Chuck is a meteorologist and trained scientist and an avid debunker of scientific fallacies, which sadly is par for the course nowadays and passed along as authoritative science without any questions. In fact, no questions are allowed. There's been some updates on a couple of stories we talked to him about recently, the ice storm and power outages in Texas, and a new development in the ongoing fight against COVID, so we want to talk about those with him. Chuck, it's great to talk to you.
Glad to be back, Mark.
Absolutely. You know, before we get to those other issues, we just wrapped up with Kim Herman about their win in federal court, which threw out the CDC's unconstitutional power grab to put a moratorium on evictions. So I'd like to put a human experience on that, because you yourself were a landlord and had some rental properties. Talk to us about your experiences with rentals.
Well, what my experience has been, Mark, is that slowly over time, and I shouldn't say real slow, it was under the Kate Brown administration in Oregon. Kate is one of the worst offenders of stealing people's property rights that have always been in existence in the state of Oregon. As everybody knows, you have a constitutional right to own property, and for the most part, do what you want with your property as long as you're not infringing upon somebody else's rights. You know, they do have restrictions on how much you can build something, how tall, that sort of thing, because it has the potential to affect other properties. But other than that, you're pretty much free, or were free, I should say, to do what you want with the property. Well, I got into that business. It started out with me many, many years ago, because I didn't own anything when I first got started in life. When I first got out of college, I had to save. I saved. I didn't spend money on things frivolously. And I reached a point in time, and the timing was right with property values in Oregon, which were depressed after the Jimmy Carter recession of the late 70s, when interest rates had to go up to almost 20% in order to combat the inflation, when the dollar was taken off the gold standard. That takes us way back into that period of time. But property values in Oregon were some of the last in the nation to recover. And so, like any good opportunist, the property values being depressed like they were, I was able to buy one of them. And I got into the rental business that way, got it at a good price, but the interest rate was 14.5%. Ouch. Imagine that. It's nowhere close to that now, but over time, I was able to leverage that because the interest rates went down and property values finally recovered from that recession. So timing is everything. And I was successful at this business for a good number of years and had good tenants, enjoyed doing it, and providing a service of a place to live for people in this area. But when Kate Brown got into office, the Democrats in the legislature began destroying property rights. And one of the first things that they did was she removed the right of a landlord to evict a tenant without cause. Now, some people would say, well, that seems reasonable to me, because why should you be able to evict somebody that if they haven't done anything wrong? Well, the sound of that is actually more devious than it is, than it actually is. Because the fact of the matter is, there aren't any landlords that I know of, myself included, that would just deliberately evict somebody for no reason. The point is, that was your, quick to use resort to get rid of a situation where there might be a problem. You know, there could be tenants that you don't get along with, that aren't taking care of your property, that are constantly late in paying. There could be a number of reasons. And to have the ability to evict without cause just means I can send somebody a 30-day notice and say, you have to vacate after 30 days. And you don't have to give them a reason to do it. It was your personal choice, but there was obviously reasons, you just don't have to get into it. That saves a lot of legal hassle. And the first thing she did was she took that right away when she started tinkering with this. And so now she turned this into a situation to where you have to actually have a tenant do three things wrong in a year's time that you feel would give right to terminate your contract. The only exclusion for that was paying rent. You did have to pay that, and nothing was changed there. But bad tenant behavior and other things, you had a three strikes rule that was substituted in for the right to evict without cause. And that causes enormous headaches for property owners, because now you have to go in and inspect your property on a much more frequent basis to see if there's any violations going on. And if there are any, you had to document them, send written notice, and all this other frivolous nonsense that just complicate things beyond belief. And then the bottom line is, to take that right of a landlord away to evict without cause also means if your tenant is going to fight you on this and it ends up in court, you will not get to decide ultimately who gets to live in your property. It is the courts that will decide it. And that's totally contrary to what property rights are supposed to be all about. And then, of course, the eviction moratoriums came into place where they just said, you know, you're not going to evict anybody at all now that COVID-19 has come into play. I can understand some of that at the beginning of this because we didn't know what we were dealing with. But the bottom line there is they also made that go back on all the property owners, because the tenant, if they lost their job, they can't pay you, but you can't evict them. And you have bills to pay, including mortgages, HOA fees, water bills in some cases. So there are bills that stack up, including insurance and property taxes, that the landlord or building owner is required to pay, and the state did nothing to give any protections to people that own the property about that.
Right.
So here you are with a tenant that can't pay, and like I said, I don't fault the tenant if they lost their job over COVID. A lot of people did. But the method in which they went about trying to create remedy for this did absolutely nothing for the property owners. It ended up putting them in a terrible position where debt was accrued over a lot of these other expenses that the state or the federal government offered no assistance for. Only recently have they offered some assistance, but it's far too little too late.
Yeah.
And so this creates an enormous problem for property owners. It's just been an outright assault on property owners and landlords since all of this started, and it isn't getting any better. They continue to just constantly tinker with people's property rights, where to be in the business now almost means you have to be one of the bigger players. You're going to have a lawyer on staff to deal with all the problems, because they also made rules that said if you get one thing wrong in administering a contract or any sort of a condition that the tenant's rights given to them under these new rules are, you can be fined up to $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000. For making one single mistake. So the underlying message was, you want to stay in the business? Well, then hire yourself a good lawyer. And it becomes all about that rather than just managing a property like you would like to do it.
Yeah.
That took all the fun out of it. Took all the fun out of it for me and made it a compounding headache. So I just decided it's not worth it. I'm, you know, get out of the business let somebody else deal with this.
I can certainly see why, for sure. And, you know, like the left always says, they only ever deal with one side of the equation. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, the fallout in Texas from all that ice and snow a few weeks back. That's next with Chuck Weiss. And welcome back. We're talking with Chuck Weiss, a meteorologist, trained scientist, and fierce global warming debunker. And Chuck, as so typical of most news items, if you want the truth, you don't turn to the mainstream media, especially when it comes to things like global warming and green energy. In the wake of catastrophic grid failures in Texas during the huge winter storms, the media blamed global warming for the ice and cold. And one little gem that I saw said that, of course, it's global warming, because if it's warmer in one part of the world, then it will be colder in another part of the world. Is that how climate and global warming works, that if I turn on my stove in my kitchen, it makes it snow in my living room?
Absolutely not. These things were falsehoods that were started by Al Gore, because I remember back in 2011 when that question was posed to him, that was a record snow year for the East Coast, and people were scratching their heads to people like Al Gore and saying, Mr. Gore, you keep saying the planet's getting warmer like a lot of these other advocates pushing this do. How come we're getting so much snow here on the East Coast? And that's when they came up with, well, when it gets warmer, the air can hold more moisture, so when it runs up against the cold, it causes more snowfall. The problem with that is, if the planet's warming, the temperature difference across the latitude lines actually decreases, the storm intensity decreases, and you get less snow, but higher humidity. That's the way that really works in reality, not the way Gore has portrayed it. So again, this lie came up this year, and it's the same old thing. But this year, it's even worse, because not only did we get the heavy snows and all this record cold, there wasn't warm in other parts of the world. The global temperatures in the last 2 months have plummeted to less than half the value they were at the beginning of the fall and the last peak before we came off of this last warm cycle with back-to-back El Niños. So it's simply not true that the snows were caused by any warming. The temperatures have fallen like a rock. And they remain low today. The February measurement from the University of Alabama, Huntsville, global temperature was plus 0.2 above the 30-year mean. And that's barely noticeable from 30 years ago as far as global temperatures go now. And we had record cold around different parts of the world. The Thames River for the first time froze over in London it was 58 years ago when that happened back in 1963. So it's simply not true that this year's storms are caused by a warming planet. It was plummeting temperatures that caused everything this year. So they don't have anything they can run to try to defend their stupid theories that are scientifically invalid and based upon just total ignorance and incompetence. Yeah. I've never seen such a destruction of real science by these people in this environmental movement. These people are absolutely nuts. They have no authority. They have no knowledge of atmospheric science. They make this stuff up as they go along to try to confuse the public and sell their narrative. And it's just awful.
Well, and speaking of making things up, the media and others, including the Biden administration, have tried to blame everything other than solar and wind, that the grid failures couldn't possibly be a result of unreliable green energy. And the AP reported it this way, quote, "The entire grid, which is unique," speaking of the grid in Texas, "which is uniquely isolated from the rest of the U.S., was on the brink of collapse in the early hours of February 15th as power plants froze in the cold and record demand for electricity to heat homes overwhelmed the system." So how exactly do coal, oil, and natural gas power plants freeze?
Well, coal certainly isn't going to do it. Natural gas lines, if they're not dehumidified a certain way, could cause some freezing of the valves. There could be an issue with that, and that's something they may have to go back and look at, but that's easy to treat. That's very easy to treat compared to a wind farm with windmills that freeze in the ice and freezing rain. You're not going to be able to solve that problem if you have another situation in Texas. But whatever there was in the way of natural gas failures, those can be rectified. You just got to go back and do it. And I think in Texas, they probably didn't dehumidify like they can in other climates because it isn't as often as you would get the sort of severe cold that they did in Texas this year. So they'll have to go back and look at that. But that, like I said, that's an easy remedy compared to a windmill and solar stuff, which is simply not going to meet any sort of major demand on the power grid. That's just not going to happen. It's just scientifically impossible. And any physicist would be able to tell you that knows energy.
Yeah, but then you're into that whole reality thing, and that's so distasteful in the media right now. There has been some interesting fallout from the Texas grid failures. The top utility regulator quit. Another one got fired, as I recall. Six board members from the Texas grid manager, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, known as ERCOT, have also all quit. So here's the thing. If all of the green energy they were pushing into oil-rich Texas was just fine and dandy and not the problem, why would all those people suddenly quit?
Well, because they're facing an embarrassing situation that they have no answers to, and then look at all the damage this has caused, these horrible policies that have all failed. And the really miserable, just horrible thing about all this, Mark, is that even if you, the whole idea of going to these renewables is we got to reduce our carbon emissions. That's the constant thing you're hearing. And now I'm hearing about they want to do carbon taxes. They want to do more renewables. This is complete insanity, and it's scientifically impossible to accomplish any of the goals that they claim they can do with the public by setting all this stuff up. There's a scientist, a physicist that I've done some work with in Montana by the name of Dr. Ed Berry, who just wrote a book, and I would recommend it to your listeners. It's called Climate Miracle, and the subtitle is There's No Climate Crisis, Nature Controls the Climate. And Ed has done some work with other physicists as well on the carbon problem and determined that if you eliminated all human emissions around the world, like these people in the green energy and these climate environmentalists say that we have to do, if you eliminated all human emissions, the change in the global atmospheric CO2 would only drop 33 parts per million. In other words, we're responsible for about 25% of all the growth in CO2 since the start of the Industrial Revolution, where it's gone up about 130 parts per million. We contributed about 33 of that, which is only 25%. So this problem is far, far less of any sort of an issue than these people claim it is, because they have claimed that the entire rise in CO2 since the start of the Industrial Revolution was human caused, and that's just not true. Dr. Berry proved and looked at the equations that were used by the IPCC to formulate all this and showed exactly where they were wrong. And his equations and modeling that he used are correct because he used real data tracking the carbon-14 isotope from the nuclear test of the 1960s. And so he created a model from that and showed exponential decay of carbon as it enters the atmosphere. It's absorbed very rapidly by nature. And it turns out if you run all those numbers and crank them out, we're responsible for 33 parts per million out of the 130, which is 25%. So this isn't even a problem. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. And like I said, if you caused a drop of 33 parts per million, you'd be creating genocide in the human race because you'd have to literally break the carbon cycle in human beings, which would kill everybody. The carbon cycle is a necessary part of life. And these people are treating it like it's going to kill us. And the opposite is true.
Yeah, that's like fifth grade science. We need carbon dioxide. So, okay, let's take a break there. New news on the COVID front. We'll wrap things up with Chuck Weiss after this. And we're back in our final segment here on the iSpy Radio Show. If you're just joining us, now is a good time to remind you that after the show airs on our network of stations and you miss part of the show or want to re-listen to it, you can catch the podcast. Search for iSpy Radio Show on your favorite podcast platform to hear it, or go to iSpyRadio.com and at the top of the page, look for the Get the Podcast tab. So, Chuck, I wanted to have you back on because you followed the COVID pandemic very closely and with a great deal of suspicion, and I think rightfully so. And the latest is the vaccines that have been rolling out, and we're interested in your evolving opinion on these vaccines as more comes to light about them. Regarding the vaccines that are currently out there, has anything changed since we last talked to you that you would now suddenly want to get either of the mRNA vaccines or even the newest one?
No, I haven't seen anything that has really changed. The new one that came out by Johnson & Johnson is still doing the same thing. It just uses an adenovirus, which is a cold virus, to instead of the little ball-like gels that they put the mRNA instructions in that interact with your own cellular biology to create the spike proteins that are targeted with your own with antibody generation by your own system to combat the virus with. So they haven't. The Johnson & Johnson really hasn't made a big change other than they used a cold virus to do pretty much the same thing. So you're still getting the cellular interaction with the virus in your own system. And as other microbiologists have talked about, this is an experimental program. I mean, we really don't know all the adverse effects from this that could possibly happen. And we've already seen a number of them since the vaccines came out. The recent ones that I saw were spontaneous miscarriages and stillbirths in pregnant women who had received this vaccine, not the Johnson & Johnson, but the other ones. But the Johnson & Johnson really isn't that much different. So I'm still very concerned about it. There's blood clot disorders. There's this with the miscarriages in women. There are also people that in the elderly population that just died within a few days after getting the vaccine. So it's still in the experimental stage, and there's just simply not enough known about this technology to really call it safe. They never did the experiments with these vaccines on animal populations like they did with SARS-CoV-1. And when they did the animal tests with SARS-CoV-1, most of the animals died from what they call an autoimmune disorder, where when they're re-exposed to the virus after getting vaccinated, they actually got much sicker with these cytokine storms and died. And we may find that to be the case here. We just don't know yet. Not enough time has gone by. But, that's definitely a real possibility with this because it happened with SARS-CoV-1, and the difference between the two viruses is not all that different. And the vaccine they tried to create with SARS-CoV-1 is similar to what they're doing now. So why would we expect any different result? And then there's these other problems that I've talked about where the impurity of the vaccine and the epitopes in it have caused these other disorders such as blood clotting and that's led to a couple of deaths, and then the other ones that I've already mentioned. So I'm not convinced at all, and I haven't changed my attitude towards it. I think the best way to go is to use the therapeutics that we know work and use those to treat it with rather than take a chance on this vaccine. But it's an individual decision, but I'm not going to be one that's inclined to take it until I see more positive results that it's going to work and that these other side effects are not serious.
Right. You know, in looking at this new vaccine from Johnson & Johnson, at first glance, I thought these did use a different type of vaccine. It was a little bit more like the old-fashioned ones. But you're right, they do use essentially, it's the same technology, the mRNA, but it's just a different delivery mechanism. But you know, in thinking about this, why not just do things normally? I mean, this whole approach of using novel approaches to viruses rather than how we've always done things, natural herd immunity or use weakened viruses as a vaccine, you know, it just makes me really suspicious that we're still not being told everything about this, either the vaccine or the virus itself.
Well, I'm suspicious of that too, because I haven't yet got a decent answer as to why they can't treat this thing like they do regular influenza viruses that they use vaccines for, where they do all of this production of the cellular stuff outside of the human body, where you're just given either the envelope proteins if they use a recombinant vaccine like in a flu shot, or you're using a deadened type virus of influenza if they use the egg or cell type manufacturing of it, and your own body doesn't interact directly. Your own cellular biology doesn't have to react with that directly. It simply recognizes the injection as a foreign substance and develops antibodies for it, and you're done. It then builds your immunity up to where if you get infected with the real virus, it recognizes that and does its job like it should.
Yeah,
but we don't have that now. And what I've been wondering, too, that makes me suspicious, I mean, and really what I don't like about all this from the beginning, Mark, was there's been so much lying about what you can do to treat COVID-19 with. All the therapeutics that we know works, you know, the CDC and the FDA have lied about this, and they went even beyond that, where they actually blocked us from being able to use these drugs.
Yep, and lying and on tops of lies on tops of lies, it doesn't make you trust people. I'm sorry, it just won't. Chuck, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, well, you're quite welcome, Mark.
Here's a thought. If it's racist to call it the China virus, why isn't it racist to call it the Brazil strain? Well, as the saying goes, to learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize. Or, to put it another way, to learn who rules your rulers, find out who you're not allowed to criticize. Be sure to check out slfliberty.com. They are a nonprofit foundation out there fighting on your behalf. If you're dealing with a constitutional issue, contact them. They want to help. And if you're not dealing with a constitutional issue, then help them out. They could use the support because, as I said, they are out there fighting for you. And as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.